Good evening. It is my pleasure today to introduce to you Adam Thirlwell. In my first conversation with Adam, I have asked him what kind of biographical background I should give you, the audience, tonight in my introduction for his lecture. And he told me the following story. For over 10 years, Adam Thirlwell worked as a professional caretaker in a zoo near Liverpool and the small village of Kirkdale. His one and only task was to take care of a penguin lady named Claudine. Claudine was a very ambitious penguin lady, and her ambitious dream it was to fly. Finally, after an unfortunate incident, including several cartons of wine, a banana tree, and a free fall, Claudine unfortunately died. After that, Adam Thirlwell, the professional penguin caretaker, was so heartbroken that he felt now he was really qualified to become a writer. In this manner, he went on making a career as a novelist. He read English at New College, Oxford, and then was a prize fellow at All Souls College, Oxford, from 2000 to 2007. His first novel, Politics, published in 2003, when Adam was 24 years old, was translated into 30 languages. His second novel, The Escape, was published in 2009. Adam Thirlwell has been awarded the Anchor Award, the Somerset Maugham Award, the Betty Trask Award, and Grantham magazine named him the best of young British novelists. A book on the international art of the novel, Miss Herbert, was published in 2007 and was just recently translated into German language under the title Der Mutable Roman. It is a book about writers and language, about loss of the well-known in life and work, a book with interest on its own substance, the novel interested in its own making and fabric, and within that a writer who is onto his own tracks, solving his own riddles and conundrums while going along. And in the tradition of a man called Oscar Wilde, believes that the only way to be serious is not to be serious at all. Garen Holcomb wrote about him, "Thirlwell writes books about the difficulty of writing books when books no longer are what they once were. Thirlwell is a literary stand-up who chooses the page over the stage." I'm particularly happy, dear Adam, that tonight you chose the stage over the page and decided to join us here at our conference. And with this, I give this very stage to Adam Thirlwell. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Henrietta. I think you should be the novelist standing up here. I think this might be the most serious talk I've ever given, so I'm sorry that I think there are no jokes whatsoever in the entire speech. And I've given it the optimistic title of Polyglots, Collectives, Copies, and Other Happy Possibilities for the Anxious Digital Novelist. And it goes like this. This might be very possibly the strangest moment in the history of the novel since Cervantes published Don Quixote. I say possibly because all descriptions of the future are destined to be, if not disproved, then made at least a little laughable. I'm very much aware of that as I speak. But let's say that the rough wisdom of the era is correct, and the digital is as much an innovation in the history of literature's technology since Gutenberg invented movable type in 1450. If that's true, then it requires, at the very least, a small adjustment in our thinking. There's a passage I've always loved in Walter Benjamin's essay on Bertolt Brecht called The Author as Producer, where Benjamin comes up with one of his famous aphorisms. And he writes, "An author who teaches writers nothing teaches no one. What matters, therefore, is the exemplary character of production, which is able first to induce other producers to produce, and second, to put an improved apparatus at their disposal." But what is an apparatus? When Benjamin was writing that essay, the technical tricks that a novelist might invent were all within the form of the novel itself. There were very few true innovations by novelists in the means of production. The apparatus that was improved was the form of the novel. Kafka, say, invented a new apparatus, but that apparatus was a way of structuring a story. And while I don't think that's so unusual to argue that a narrative mode can be a mode of production in the same way as a sentence structure can, but still, these are not the only models of production that a novelist should consider. If we date the history of the novel from Cervantes' Don Quixote, then the history of the novel is mainly the history of a particular technology. The novelist writes a novel by hand, which is then set up in print. It lasted like that until the 19th century, when one variation was added to this history, in which the novelists like Henry James or Proust dictated rather than wrote the initial draft. In the 20th century, the typewriter, scissors and glue allowed for a certain speed of cut and paste, as practiced by domestic surrealists like Bohumil Hrabal. But it's only now that a true and universal difference in technology may be emerging, in the digital composition and then distribution of the novel. And so the first question that maybe needs to be asked is there a difference between a novel and a book? And if there is, then what is it? Not every novelist, for instance, believes that any difference exists. And I think of a speech by Milan Kundera given recently to the Bibliothèque Nationale in Paris, where he explained how he would never allow a digital version of his novels to be made so that people would be forced to read them, he wrote, only on paper, not on a screen. It makes me think of Heidegger, of the apparently paradoxical fact that following the worst years of the 20th century, in his university courses, he concentrated on the question of technology, to state that technology, its accelerated evolution, is capable of changing the very essence of human life. But before I enter this game of definitions, I want to pause on the history of art. Because in the history of art, everyone knows that there is such a thing as medium specificity. A photo of a painting does not have the same value as the painting itself. And yet there are art forms where this distinction seems more fluid or more disregarded. In 2011, Tassos Dean made a giant piece for Tate Modern with the beautifully literal title of Film, which was partly an assertion of the specificity of the medium of 16mm film against any digital equivalents. For the catalogue, she asked a variety of artists, filmmakers and writers, of which I was one, to comment on the intertwining of film and digital. One of my favourites was from the great filmmaker Jonas Mekas and his A Mini Manifesto Re-Cinema, in which he made the lovely comparison: all editions of films, motion pictures, on MSC video, digital formats, should be considered and presented only as secondary information on the works presented, just as photographic reproductions of works of art in books. But somehow, in the art of the novel, this distinction seems more tenuous, more complicated. For after all, a novel is inherently a reproducible art. Every reader is an owner of multiples. Or, as John Baldessari once put it, since everyone can own a book, nobody owns it. Which is why, when I think about the text I wrote for Tassos Dean's catalogue, I'm struck by how quick it was, how speedy with assumptions. Back then, in 2011, I had two worries. The first was a worry about how visible the composition of a novel might be in its new digital format. And my second was about the way in which the digital allowed many intrusions into the privacy of reading. The digital was always a medium that was useful for the industry, the endlessly monitored cloud, and therefore I was worried about the effects of such financial calculations on the novelist. A novelist, I wrote, who might start to feel the pressure of a single schema, and that schema will be savage suspensefulness, the lurid kaboom of the opening, then the continued kaboom of each chapter. Now, I will come back to both these points, the problem of the reader being able to follow the composition, and the problem of the reader's responses being immediately available as financial data. But first, I would possibly say that I'm worried by how reactionary I seem, or how scared. It's true, I ended with an important, small, optimistic addition, but I never entertained that possibility, not really. And well, in everything I write, I dislike the era of romanticism, and yet there seems to me something romantic in this belief that the book and the novel are somehow insolubly related. For after all, is the difference between a digital film and a 16mm film a good analogy for a novel? A digital film and a 16mm film are both, after all, pictures. As Tacitus wrote, one is light on emulsion and one is light made by pixel. And a pixel picture is different to an emulsion one, just as an oil painting is different to a watercolor. No one sees the medium as an interchangeable vehicle for the image. But if you think that the words of a novel are identical, whether reproduced in print or on a screen, then there is a problem. And so, in answer to that question I initially posed, is there a difference between a novel and a book? I think it's clear that yes, there obviously is. A novel is still the same novel, whether existing as an MP3 file or digitally on a screen. What is a novel? I would want to give a definition as general and as literal as possible. I would say something as stupid as, a novel is a composition of words. For in the end, the medium in the art of the novel has never been important. That's why the writing and reading of novels is a very strange art. A word is not a medium, but an element in a code. And therefore, if I consider the image of the future avant-garde novelist, then that novelist should be just as interested in the possibilities of the new digital medium as the possibilities of the book. For the art of the novel, it turns out, has never been medium-specific. And when I say digital, I mean it in every possible way, and will refer to different elements of the digital haphazardly, not just the digital novel itself, but also the possibilities of composition, the possibilities of reading, and finally, the possibilities of distribution. All of these aspects of novelistic production are altered or extended by the digital universe. And so, for instance, to take an example that's both readerly and writerly, let's consider the issue of length. Length is one of the most obvious innovations that the digital offers, where a book is limited in its size by certain human considerations. Which was why I love, say, the experiment of the American novelist Paul Lafarge, who recently published a novel called Luminous Airplanes. This novel seemed, in a way, a finely crafted novel of the old school, but it also came with an accompanying website. And that website contained vast amounts of story and invention which, while related to the novel published in book form by Farrar, Straus, and Giroux, were not in any way part of the book either. On that website, Lafarge offered a lovely map, showing the reader the entirety of the fictional universe he'd created, with the novel as published in book form being identified too. It was a small island lost in a vast, uncharted universe. A map of luminous airplanes, he called it, and then, in brackets, outside of time and space. But at the same time, I'm not sure if what Lafarge calls the immersive text of this website or of this novel represents such a deep innovation. There can be novels that exploit digital possibilities, but in the form of a book, like Lawrence Stern's Tristram Shandy or Nabokov's Pale Fire. And then there's the example of what still seems to me to be the most experimental novel ever published, Marcel Proust's À la recherche du temps perdu. The most radical effects of that novel are dependent precisely on one of his central innovations, to make the novel the site of manic proliferation. With the giant length of that novel, Proust managed to construct a book whose theme is time and memory, but whose voice becomes an exercise in time and memory for its reader. He created a novel that is also performance art. The reader is forced into slowness and into forgetting. It's impossible to hold this novel entire in your mind. Characters change names or appearance or status. They reappear and disappear. They are part of a pattern that is too large to be completely apprehended. This is true of every novel, I suppose, but Proust realized that this everyday infinite experience therefore had implications that had not yet been explored in the art of the novel. And in a mini flourish, like a Renaissance artist including his own portrait, he offered an example of this deep problem within the action of his novel itself, where Marcel, the narrator, struggles to understand the form of a sonata that is so adored by two of his friends, Swann and his wife, Odette. The problem, he considers, is the human brain. And he writes, "What's missing the first time is probably not understanding, but memory. Our memory span, relative to the complexity of the impressions which assail it as we listen, is infinitesimal, as short-lived as the memory of a sleeping man who has 1,000 thoughts which he instantly forgets. Our memory is incapable of supplying us with an instantaneous recollection of this multiplicity of impressions." It's an observation of such delicacy that its explosive effects might not be immediately obvious. But just think about it. In 1939, for instance, when Igor Stravinsky was giving a lecture in Harvard, he told his students, "The plastic arts are presented to us in space. We receive an overall impression before we discover details little by little and at our leisure. But music is based on temporal succession and requires alertness of memory. Consequently, music is a chronologic art, as painting is a spatial art." And the novel is a chronologic art too. It's an art of succession. This is why Milan Kundera once said in a dialogue in The Art of the Novel that the only rule of a novel's form is that there are anthropological limits, the limits of memory, for instance, that ought not to be exceeded. When you reach the end of a book, you should still find it possible to remember the beginning. But the problem with this argument is there in the quotation from Proust. Even the smallest sentence evades our attention. Our memories are not really good enough for even the shortest of stories. How to put this? Proust, in his novel, is no longer doing a portrait. It's no longer description, but invention. His novel is a machine for the reader. Or to put this another way, a novel has usually been seen as an object. But what if a novel could be a process? For after all, this is how a novel works. It begins as a process of thinking for the novelist, which ends as a novel. But this novel for the reader is then an experience itself, which is lived sequentially. Yes, the novel is too often at the moment still just a record of something that happened, whereas really it needs to be a machine for creating private events. Those events might well be gruesome, tender, needy. They may be absolutely difficult to express for the inarticulate reader. They might make you want to throw the book away and reject it. They might make you confuse the author, the narrator, because everything is mushy and distasteful. I do not care. I only care about being precise about Proust's giant discovery. Normal novels, you realize, are far too fast. They try to disguise the fact that they are farces, small festivals of improbable coincidence, but they cannot. The only honest novels are very short or very long. For Proust changed the way plot was organized in fiction. Proust constructs his novel in blocks of scenes or portraits. His novel is like an aquarium in which you pass from fish to fish, all bathed in the strange luminosity of his sentences. Normally, novelists constructed causation from paragraph to paragraph, whereas Proust does something more truthful. His causes are scattered from book to book. And it means that a new kind of reading is invented by Proust's discovery. There's the usual form of reading to begin at the beginning and keep going until you reach the end. But another possibility is hinted at in the stacked way Proust constructs his paragraphs, like some giant millefeuille. Wherever you enter the composition, the deep structure is always already present, which means that the reader can join anywhere and leave whenever she likes. As Deleuze noticed in his great book, Proust and Signs, the true subject of Proust's novel is an apprenticeship in signs. It is true of the narrator and also of the reader. This is why his novel is so strange and so important. It forces the reader to become part of the artwork's pattern too. And this is why I could imagine that the digital versions of such a novel would offer a reader a far more satisfying experience. For the digital, after all, is much more exploitable and searchable. I could imagine a roaming kind of reading, grazing amongst the text. And it's that aleatoric, randomizing reading that the digital form seems to me to make even more possible. For a book, in the end, cannot really be reordered, whereas the map of Paul Lafarge's novel on the internet can be reconstructed in whatever order the reader likes. Digitally, the reader is truly free. Just as Mark Saporta's novel, Composition No. 1, first published as a book in a box in 1962, only fully attained its truly aleatoric existence when the London publisher Visual Editions recently published it not only in a physical box, but also as an app for iPad. For in the end, very few readers of the book will do more than rearrange the elements of its pages more than once. It is basically a static form. Whereas on the iPad, the entire text scrolls at high speed down the screen, only pausing when the reader puts her finger on it. As soon as she lifts it up, the high-speed scrolling begins again. Every reading of this novel, therefore, in its digital form, is different. It's only with the digital that the dream of the random sequence fully exists. And I would argue that novelists have not yet exhausted all the possibilities that the digitally random offers. On the other hand, there is beauty in shortness, too. For one worry I have with the digital medium is related to composition. For how many novels now are composed first in longhand? I am 35, and I know no one of my age or younger who writes a novel in handwriting first. Notes, absolutely, perhaps short drafts of chapters, but all the composition really is done on a screen. And the danger of such composition is how easy it is. It means that you happily produce more words, knowing that the material can be rearranged and deleted at any time. But such rearrangement becomes more difficult the more material there is to be arranged. What is missing in electronic composition is decision. In the same way as digital film always produces too many images to be ordered in post-production, so writing always creates more material than is necessary. And yet, the digital seems to me to be an ideal way for performing more experiments with shortness. And I think of one of the most interesting novelists working today, the Mexican novelist Mario Beatin. For Beatin has always loved to investigate the possibilities of prank fictions and potential fictions. Like Borges, he has used fiction to explore the possibility of new universes or universes nested inside other universes. Like in his book, Shiki Nagaoka, A Nose for Fiction, his biography of an imaginary Japanese writer and artist. But the project which interests me the most is something he published in a pamphlet for Documenta in Kassel, the 100,000 books of Beyatin. It is a proposal for a new kind of physical library, but I think that really it is a project whose essence is the digital. For although in this pamphlet Beyatin proposes a dream of a personal library, Mario Beyatin, he writes, is a writer who wants his books always on hand, not only the texts, but the books themselves. And although he claims that these books will go on sale only if someone is interested in owning them, these books are made available, not marketed. They are in a sort of gelatinous state of exchange, so that their physicality as objects is in a way the point. Yes, despite all this, I think that something else is really going on. Just consider the 100 topics he proposes for books to be published in editions of 1,000 each. Things as fleeting and notebook-like as the dogs that usually sleep in my room number 5. I have to follow a strict routine to take care of them all. If not, I would seem like a victim of the Noah syndrome. Or, in one sentence, I published a book with city lights. These topics are a way of investigating whether a novel needs to be written at all for it to be a novel. And Beyatin's experiment makes me imagine a possible route for fiction, for it to become much more evanescent, jotted, sketchy, for it to recover a kind of fiction that I think has been slightly lost, or in fact more than one tradition. Because just as much as it is related to the metafictions of Borges or Monterosso, it also, in its evanescent form, seems to me to point to another equally sporadic tradition, the notebook novels of Hampson, Rilke, Pessoa. For this is what a digital form can do. In its infinite elasticity of form, it can just as much allow the miniature as the very long. And in fact, I think that the endlessness of the digital medium can also be exploited by this shortness too. I've always been interested in how fictions can also be rumors. I wonder if, in fact, a work that exists as a rumor is the ideal to which every work aspires. A work that exists as a rumor is what we mean by a masterpiece. It has created an experience to be discussed. So that just as you can think you have seen the Mona Lisa without ever visiting the Louvre, or just as you know what Tokyo looks like without ever being to Japan, so the great works are those which have leaked in their strange way into the everyday miasma. In other words, one of my artistic idols is the Belgian artist Francis Alice, who works in Mexico City, and who described his practice in this way. When I stepped out of the field of architecture, my first impulse was not to add to the city, but to absorb what was already there, to work with the residues or with the negative spaces, the holes, the spaces in between. Because of the immense amount of material produced on a daily basis by a huge city like Mexico City, it is very difficult to justify the act of adding another piece of matter to that already saturated environment. My reaction was to insert a story into the city rather than an object. It was my way of affecting a place at a very precise moment of its history, even just for an instant. If the story is right, if it hits a nerve, it can propagate like a rumor. Stories can pass through a place without the need to settle. They have a life of their own. If the script meets the expectations and addresses the anxieties of that society at the right time and place, it may become a story that survives the event itself. At that moment, it has the potential to become a fable or an urban myth. And where else, I would argue, will this work better for a novelist than in the infinite horizontal networks of the digital? This reminds me, there's an essay by the Argentinian novelist Cesar Ayra called The New Writing, where Ayra tries to define what an avant-garde might be. The way I see it, he writes, the avant-garde emerged at a point when the professionalizations of artists had consumed itself and it became necessary to start again from scratch. Art had already been invented and the only thing to be done was to go on producing works, and the myth of the avant-garde came about to restore the possibility of making the journey from the origin again. If the actual process had taken 2,000 or 3,000 years, he continues, what the avant-garde proposed could only function as a simulacrum or a pantomime version, hence the ludic or, at any rate, the not-too-serious quality, the carnivalesque instability which avant-garde movements have possessed. The avant-garde novelist, in Ira's reading, has the difficult task of restoring evolution to a process that seemed, in the 19th century novel, to have reached its natural conclusion. And the way in which Ira thinks the avant-garde can restore such evolution is therefore not to invent new forms, since every form is exhausted, but new procedures. In My Personal Vision, he writes, procedure is the avant-garde's principal tool. It is the only remaining way of reconstructing the radicalism which is an essential part of art. And there's something in this vision of Ira's which seems very important for any future novelist. He's arguing for a technological idea of an art. And in relation to a digital future, this seems more and more important. When understood in this sense, as inventors of procedures, he writes, the relevance of avant-garde artists today is clear. They have populated the 20th century with treasure maps waiting to be discovered and exploited. Constructivism, automatic writing, the ready-made, dodecaphonism, cut-ups, chance, indeterminacy. The great artists of the 20th century are not those who created works, but those who created procedures through which works could be made alone, or indeed not made. Rather than works, Ira prefers processes. The true avant-garde, in fact, has always replaced works with processes. This achievement also has other implications, he adds, that art can be made by all, that it can be liberated from psychological restrictions, and most of all, that what we think of as the work can be the method by which the work is made, rather than the actual work itself. In this rewritten history of procedures, the digital represents a giant area of investigation. And in particular, I think, the digital can allow the novelist to become multiple. For now, I'd like to sketch just two of these possibilities. The first is the possibility of collective writing, because I'd say that the dream of a collective has been one of the avant-garde's ghosts. But every collective has always had the problem that a truly multiple work is very difficult to produce. The collective is a procedure that has never quite occurred, always subject to the politics of people's selves or styles. Whereas digitally, the necessary refusal of psychology is much easier to produce. It can be done as simply as the opening of a Google document, which can be accessed by two or more people simultaneously wherever they are in the world. Yes, I think this basic digital invention could be very important in the history of the novel. For with this program, it becomes possible not only to make works from within a collective, but to write collectively too. And the second is the possibility of making the multiple that is a translation into something much more part of a novelist's thinking. For one obvious collective work that could be done is, of course, a translation. I could imagine a future novelist working simultaneously with her translators, with the document being made international as it is composed. And here, I think it's possible to see one happy possibility for future distribution. A digital text no longer needs to be so separate from its translations. A future mode of publication could be deeply international, with simultaneous publication in various other languages. For in the end, the digital offers one deep possibility, to make the novel even more playful, to make it less a medium of the novelist's personality and more of a game, a system of noises and signals. In its total flatness, the digital seems to me in particular to lend itself to new ways in which to multiply and confuse the usual boundaries between selves. One aspect of the digital novel, after all, is that it exists as one text inside the giant archive of world literature. And so I would like to imagine a future made of copies and collages, where games with quotation and pastiche become much more intricate and crazed. Okay, this has already happened in the history of art. I keep remembering an interview Hans-Ulrich Obrist did with Elaine Sturtevant, that artist of perfect copies, where she melancholically pointed out, in terms of copy and copyright, it's impossible to have a discourse about it. You absolutely cannot discuss copyright with lawyers because it's a complete impasse and won't even come close to a discourse or dialogue. If you start talking to them about why copyright is no longer viable, they close the conversation. Copyright is not copyright anymore, but more about how this world is functioning. It's not about the law, it's about our way of being. And copy has very different dynamics than something that resembles something else. But it's not an interesting topic anymore. It's not viable. But I can also say that Duchamp is not viable. And okay, this kind of copying has already happened slightly with Kenneth Goldsmith's idea of conceptual poetry, his massive transcripts of newspapers and radio broadcasts. But there is a problem with Goldsmith's practice, I think, a problem that demonstrates how early it is in any history of digital writing. Those transcripts are so boring to read. For the endlessness of material that can be found digitally is the readerly equivalent of the endlessness of composition. The problem for the digital is the possibility of a formlessness that is not intricate, as in Proust, but only slack. What's needed is an advance in the novelistic art of collage, something as rigorous, say, as the collage films of Christian Marclay. Sure, we need new processes, but I don't think that needs to mean the total disintegration of the work. A work as a formal construction is the only way for artistic investigation to do its thinking. It is only with the work as a model that the game with the reader, with sincerity, obscenity, revelation, playfulness, makes sense. Because every process is only meaningful because it has some kind of rule. A few years back, there was a small argument in the New York Times between Kevin Kelly, an editor at Wired magazine, and the novelist John Updike. In his article, Kelly happily predicted a future where all books would melt into the soup of a digitized universal library. The library not as a collection of works, but of all works mixed together. The universal library becomes one very, very, very large single text, he wrote, the world's only book. And this universal library will allow a different manner of writing and of reading, argued Kelly, where works are chopped up into snippets and remixed. Now, I have some sympathy for this kind of thinking, but I also have some sympathy for the scared reply of John Updike, who worried that what was essential to reading, accountability and intimacy, would be lost in this digital future. He ended on a simple question. Books traditionally have edges. Some are rough cut, some are smooth cut, and a few, at least at my extravagant publishing house, are even top stained. In the electronic anthill, where are the edges? But in this argument, it seems to me that both Kelly and Updike are wrong. They have both failed to see that a work is independent of its medium, and without works, the thinking that is done by reading and writing is impossible. And yet, I do love the possible utopia. I love the idea that these new methods of production also provide us with a new apparatus. It offers a way of writing literature that is not saturated in that literature's history. Or rather, it offers a way of writing where that history can be rearranged, just as the digital reader can rearrange the elements of the individual work. In Walter Benjamin's notorious essay on the work of art in the era of mechanical reproduction, he famously argued that the mechanical reproduction of artworks had put authenticity in jeopardy, and therefore the transmissibility of history, the object's authority. But it has always struck me that although he mentions the printing press towards the beginning of his essay, he never returns to the art of writing. And the reason can only be that writing represents a limit case, an extreme on the other side of reproduction. Of course, Benjamin could argue that that which withers in the age of mechanical reproduction is the aura of the work of art. One might generalize by saying the technique of reproduction detaches the reproduced object from the domain of tradition. But I'm not so convinced here by Benjamin's tone. It's true that I do not want an art divorced from all tradition, but also it seems to me that the art of the novel, this art based on reproduction, has always enjoyed playing with a refusal of its history. In his essay on the new writing, César Ayra's example of a perfect work was John Cage's music piece, Music of Changes, based on chance procedures and the I Ching. And Ayra added, Cage justified the use of chance, saying that in such a way it's possible to make a musical composition, the continuity of which is free of individual taste and memory, psychology, and also of the literature and traditions of the art. The dream of the avant-garde, I would add, has always been to dismantle the ghostliness of history. And yet still, I do not want to be only happy. And my real melancholy is when I consider the possible problems of distribution. Because sure, on the one hand, the digital offers a new possibility of distribution. It allows a kind of new trickling, seeping ecosystem where texts can be given away, where readers and writers can be in some ideal proximity. But this is, after all, the era of the cloud and of the NSA. The danger, either financially or politically, is of a total surveillance. And the digital is the most beautiful medium invented, not just for a future novelist, but also a future dictator. For we should not forget that the organizations that often clamor for a new novel, for a novel digitized and made purely electronic, for a novel accessible to a utopian community, are often those who in fact really want a more economically accessible work, one that isn't more artistic, but more open to advertising. In my text for Tacita Dean, I worried about the way in which every page click is monitored and was fearful for the future in avant-garde if every composition was subjected to the terror of the thriller. Just as I worry about that digital library too, if it will mainly only be accessed by readers advised by algorithms, manipulated into smaller and smaller areas of learning. But then, there is no life without ambiguity. One of the most brilliant recent examinations of this, to offer a Documenta twin to Beatin, was by Boris Groys, who in a pamphlet for Documenta discussed the new linguistics we all submit to, the philosophy of Google. Today, he wrote, we practice our dialogue with the world primarily via the internet. If we want to ask the world questions, we act as internet users. And if we want to answer the questions that the world asks us, we act as content providers. In both cases, our dialogical behavior is defined by the specific rules and ways in which the questions can be asked and answered within the framework of the internet. Under the current regime in which the internet functions, these rules and ways are predominantly defined by Google. Everyone here knows what this dialogue looks like. And Groys continues, every question has to be formulated as one word or a combination of words. The answer is given as a set of contexts in which this word or combination of words may be discovered by the search engine. This means that Google defines the legitimate question as one about the meaning of an individual word. And it identifies the legitimate answer to this question as a display of all the accessible contexts in which this word occurs. And so, argues Groys in a brilliant extrapolation, Google is an avant-garde entity. It is the pure futurist machine. Google dissolves all discourses by turning them into the word clouds that function as collections of words beyond grammar. These word clouds do not say anything. They only contain or do not contain this or that particular word. Accordingly, Google presupposes the liberation of individual words from their grammatical chains, from their subjection to language understood as a grammatically defined word hierarchy. And yet, there is a problem. Because since Google is not infinite, and since we know that its algorithm pre-selects and is therefore a very limited offering of all the available contexts, a certain conspiracy thinking takes over. And so the subject of a Google search becomes involved in a struggle for the truth that is on the one hand metaphysical and on the other hand political and technological. That is the ambiguity in which we are currently situated. Or as Groys wrote, really existing Google can only be criticized from the poetic perspective of what can be called a utopian Google, a Google that embodies the concept of equality and freedom for all words. For let's be clear, politically, the digital is nearly always the agent of division. The digital is the medium not only of literature, but also finance. The digital can enforce an absolute conservatism aided by its imposition of a total distraction. But while one radical alternative might be therefore to abandon the digital entirely, to explore materials, objects, a kind of animalistic avant-garde which in the art of the novel would be represented by a return to the tactility of the book, there is another form of radicalism available too, to appropriate the digital. And it is the possibility of such appropriation and gleeful misuse that makes me very happy for the unpredictable future. Thank you.
Thank you, Adam. We would now open the panel for questions, if there are some, by some present lawyers maybe in the room, I could imagine, or by somebody else. Yes?
I was just wondering how do you talk about the fact that so many of your examples come from...
That so many of your examples come from the world of art rather than the world of literature?
It's because I prefer art to literature.
I mean, are the same arguments taking place in both fields, or do you think art is kind of engaging more with these questions, or, I don't know, is it a time-lapse thing?
Yeah, I don't know. I think it does slightly just reflect my slight preference. Like, often I'm more interested at the moment in contemporary art practice than maybe contemporary literary practice. But I think that might be part, like, there is a more general point, which is that I think these kind of questions, it does seem that there's a kind of phenomenon of jet lag where literature is slowly kind of crossing some huge Pacific Ocean and the art world has slightly got there already. So certainly the kind of discussion that someone like Sturtevant has been having in her art for years is something that maybe novelists, I think, only, maybe the digital is going to speed things up for novelists because it's kind of forcing these kind of questions more into the open. But yeah, so probably I think in some way it does reflect that maybe often I think the writers I'm interested in more and more of contemporary writers often have some connection to the art world as well. It seems to me that there's a kind of energy of discussion and an innovation of discussion that is slightly absent in the more conventional literary world.
Questions? We can't really see you up here because it's really bright. So, yeah, Martha? Over there?
Yeah. I love what you say about collaborativity, naturally. Could you talk a little bit about the impediment that copyright law is going to place in the road to this kind of wonderful warm bathtub that you're envisioning?
Yes, it's going to. I mean, I think at the moment, I think it's true that if you, I think novelists have not really, I think novelists and copyright, they kind of, not just novelists, but any writer, I think, is slightly naive in the sense that I think they unthinkingly assume that copyright is kind of a natural birthright. And it's true that in the kind of collective writing, I think that this partly why I like Google Docs so much is because it basically erases each person's contribution. You can't tell who made which mark, that there's no way post facto that anyone could kind of say, well, that was my sense. There probably is digitally if you could, but kind of on the screen, everything looks the same. But it's true, I didn't give it enough thought, but it's evidently going to be a problem because I think even novelists in a collective, it will be that one, they will not only have to change their practice to write collectively, but they will have to change their assumptions about how it would be produced and what they own of it. Definitely. It seems to me that the technical, the legal problem is there, but I sort of feel like just getting writers to write collectively would be a start.
It's very sweet that the Beatles actually solved this already back in the 1960s.
No one has. I had one. I really like your remark, and I think maybe some other people in the room as well, that a novel existing as a rumor is the real version of a masterpiece. I'm sorry, I don't quote you quite right, fine. But I would be super interested to hear more about that, like one or two sentences. Maybe you could elaborate.
Yeah, well, I think just thinking, it's about, I'm really interested in Alice in his way of this idea of not wanting to add another object, that there seems to me something kind of philosophically strange about if you only think of as a work as a copy of, like there seems to be such a simple kind of philosophy of the idea that, the realist idea that you're in some way mimicking the world. If that's all writing were, I think it would be no point doing it. So it's partly, I think I'm interested in thinking more precisely about how works exist in people's memories after they've read them. You know, that even a book you've loved, barely exists in your brain. Like, it's always humiliating to realize, I personally, like, how little I can remember of books I say I love. But that there is always something that remains, and that which is much closer to, like, kind of some kind of strange, slightly animalistic kind of idea of just something that's just an atmosphere that's still there. And I think I was also thinking, almost in a Philistine way, I love the fact that there are novels which, you know, Proust is one of the great examples. Everyone knows the story of the Madeleine. Mm-hmm. They don't need to have read the novel. Mm. And obviously that's not the whole of Proust, but there is a deep way in which that is Proust, that's everything that kind of, that there is a way in which that kind of, the fame of that novel is just as real as the novel itself, and is the kind of mark that there's something extraordinary about it, is that it's managed to become something that you don't need to have read in order to actually kind of think about, that loads of people will think about a Madeleine, people will describe something that happened to them as Proustian, without ever kind of engaging with the actual work itself. So I think it was a mixture of how in the actual reading it's becoming a kind of rumor in your own head, but also how in society I think a really great work kind of seeps out, you know, that's the kind of definition of it.
So it's a new form of an oral kind of practice.
Yeah, slightly. And I think why the digital is one of the great things the digital universe has shown is that it's amazing, and for better or worse, at rumors. It's amazing at kind of wrong stories, misinformation, and I think there's something to be exploited there, fictionally. Like your story of the penguin, for instance.
It's a lady penguin.
Lady penguin, sorry.
Thank you very much for your talk. It's so nice to hear something about Proust. But there's also the question, I'm not sure if he finished the work by himself. I think his household wife somehow used the scissor and rearranged it. And there I come to a question, the question of work-life balance and the question of infinity somehow, that it's very difficult to finish and conclude such a work like Proust's Recherche. And my fear is that the digitization of which you spoke, for example, the relation between a translator and the author, which immediately starts, leads to a process where you can only work for your work, and you get in a spiral of infinity where you never find a definite point where the work is finished. And somehow this can go into a spiral where you only write. And I see this a bit as danger, for example, just as a joke, when you had to write a novel in stone carving, this would be different.
I'm glad I don't have to write a novel with stone carving. Yeah, it's true. Proust is a really interesting example because, yeah, that he would revise the proofs. And so I think it's only the first four of the seven books that he actually finished revising, so which are technically finished. And the last three, I don't think it's true that his house, Céleste Albaret, I don't think she actually had a hand in the writing. But it is true that he didn't revise them. So there's a way in which, technically, it's true, A la Recherche kind of, there's a way in which he died kind of in the middle. But I would say there's still, and I think, I wouldn't call A la Recherche, though, a kind of, in a sense, I agree it's unfinished, technically, but it seems to me that one can see exactly what he did to the volumes he did revise. I think you can see what he would have done. The gap isn't so huge, and so while, and it's a work that he would have finished, it's so that the death is, as it were, it's not that he couldn't finish it. So there is a difference, I think, between that and other, like some say Kafka's novels, which he obviously left, and he didn't consider them finished. And I agree that there is a danger of the unfinished work, and yet, slightly, I think that's something that quite appeals to me. I mean, actually, like the book I've just published in German, Der Multiple Roman, is a book that I've actually revised for its translation, and it's actually changed almost every time I've brought it out. So that while there's now no original of this book, basically. And there's a way in which I quite like the idea that the digital would allow me almost to sort of, the fact that one could get rid of previous editions also quite interests me, that you could actually keep revising. And so there's a way in which you could say that's the high point of the author and the work coinciding because, say, I don't know, when Henry James comes to revise his works for the New York edition of his novels. There's now a really interesting problem, I think, with publication of his novels in, say, a series like the Penguin Classics, where often editors will say, oh, well, the early version that he first published, we prefer to the version he finished, that he revised 20 years later, so we're going to just publish the first edition. And in one sense, I think that's entirely against the author's wishes and is wrong. And that had the digital universe existed then, Henry James could have simply deleted all of the previous ones, and only the New York edition would have stood. So there are ways in which you could see the unfinished as something rather wonderful, as a way of the kind of work on the work continuing. At the same time, I do agree that in the way that there's the soup of the digital library, that's a kind of danger where all edges disappear. There is definitely a danger. I agree that you could therefore never say that any version, because always any novel could then be kind of reworked. Nothing would ever be finished. But then that can be seen as a kind of interesting possibility too.
Okay, I think also time is kind of up. So we will make a 10-minute break now, and then hopefully all meet again in the Konferenzraum 1, K1, for the Fiktion-Werkstatt-Gespräch. Thank you.
Thank you.